Benevolence is defined as the disposition to do good. Benevolence, it's the inclination to engage in kind or charitable acts. And while the benevolent acts that lead us to promote the prosperity and happiness of others can make us feel good inside, every Christian must begin to grasp that the beauty of benevolence, it has less to do with those warm and fuzzy feelings that we experience, and it has more to do with the opportunity to reflect the omnibenevolent nature of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And while the main function of benevolence is based on the act of feeding people and caring for the needs of the poor, the main purpose of benevolence is this. The main purpose of benevolence is to draw people to God through the social expression of Christian charity. Here in our study today, we're going to consider the beauty of benevolence. And as we continue our study of 1 Samuel chapter 30, David is going to help us to see, number one, that benevolence is beautiful because it's help for the helpless. Secondly, we'll see that benevolence is beautiful because it provides for the powerless. And thirdly, today we'll see that benevolence is beautiful because it brings hope to the hopeless. With this as our outline, let's open our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 30, because there we find David demonstrating the beauty of benevolence, and he does this by first helping the helpless. As you turn to 1 Samuel 30, I want to set the stage for our study today, and it'll help to remind you of the attack that occurred in the city of Ziklag. It was in our text last week that we learned about the Amalekites and how they attacked the city of Ziklag. And remember, Ziklag, that's where David and his men and all of their families were living. And they waited for David and his men to go off to battle. And after they left, the Amalekites went into Ziklag and they robbed Ziklag and they captured and kidnapped the wives and children of these men and they burned the city to the ground. Well, as David and his men were returning home, they soon discovered that the Amalekites had taken their wives and had captured their children. And with this background in mind, I want to continue our exposition of 1 Samuel chapter 30. I want to begin reading there at verse 9, because there we learn that David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men. For 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. Then they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David. And they gave him bread and he ate. And they let him drink water. And they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. Now, I want to stop right here, because here in these verses, we find David and his 600 men, and they're pursuing the Amalekites. They're pursuing the enemies who came in and kidnapped their families. And as they arrived there at the brook Besor, they took bread and they drank some water, they rehydrated, and they just started to gain some energy back. And you see, while this brook wasn't very far away from Ziklag, I need to remind you that these men had just returned from a 3-day journey from the Philistine battle lines, which means this. They were probably very tired. They were probably very hungry. Imagine on your way home thinking that your wife is there at the house. She's probably got some fresh food waiting for you. You're hungry, but you're going to wait till you get there because you don't want to spoil your dinner. And so you get there and you don't find a freshly cooked meal. You find a burned down city. And you're instantly put to flight. You're running and chasing the people who just kidnapped your family. And so these guys are hungry, and they're thirsty. And they find this brook, and they stop for some much-needed water. As a result, at this point in time, a third of David's men, they decided that they were unable to keep up with the rest of the group. And so they decided to stay there at this brook. Notice again there at verse 10. There we learn that David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. Well, here in this verse, we learn that David was pursuing the Amalekites. And I should point out that the word pursue found there in verse 10, it actually comes from a Hebrew word which refers to a person who is chasing another by running as fast as they can. And from this, I'm guessing that David's pace, as he was pursuing the Amalekites, it was so fast that 200 of these guys, they were just like, we can't keep up. We can't keep up with this pace. And so rather than slowing the whole group down, these men decided, hey, you guys are going so fast, we're just going to hang back, and you guys run as fast as you can. We're going to stay here at the brook Besor. As a result, there were 400 men who continued their pursuit of the Amalekites, and they were able to move more quickly, and the reason why is this, because the 200 men who stayed there at the brook, well, they were no longer slowing down the rest of the guys, and not only that, but these guys who were carrying all this equipment, all of their military equipment, they were able to leave all that equipment there at the brook. They were able to leave or shed themselves of all the weight of the equipment that they were carrying. So they took just what they needed. They probably took swords and spears and battle equipment of that nature, but they were able to run faster because they were able to shed the weight and leave it there with those 200 men. Well, as they continued their pursuit, it wasn't long until they found a helpless man in the middle of a field. Notice again there in verse 11. There we learn that they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David, and they gave him bread and he ate, and they let him drink water. Now, as we consider this helpless man who is found there in the field, I should point out that it would have been very easy for David and his men to just pass him by without giving it much thought at all. They were on a mission. They had a plan. They wanted to capture these Amalekites. And here's this Egyptian guy out in a field, and he's hungry, but hey, what can we do about it? We got business to take care of. They could have just passed him by and forgotten all about him and let him die. But they didn't. David and his men actually stopped and provided benevolent aid to this starving Egyptian. As a matter of fact, look with me again there at 1 Samuel chapter 30. I want to begin at verse 12, because there we learn that they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. Now here in this verse, we find David and his men. They're revealing the beauty of benevolence by providing help for this helpless man. And while they could have allowed this man to starve to death out there in that field, they didn't. Instead, they nursed him back to health. They shared food with him. They shared water with this helpless man. And in so doing, they are helping us to see the beauty of benevolence. They're helping us to see the benevolence of our God, who is a God who helps the helpless. Well, not only that, but their act of benevolence also provided them with a valuable ally. And with this in mind, I want to pick up in our text. I want to begin reading at verse 13. There we learn that David said to him, "To whom do you belong and where are you from?" And he said, "I'm a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite. And my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick. We made an invasion of the southern area of the Chethrolites in the territory which belongs to Judah and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." And David said to him, "Can you take me down to this troop?" So he said, "Swear to me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this troop." And when he had brought him down, there they were, spread out over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. Then David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Now here in these verses, we learn that David's benevolence actually paid off. You see, this wasn't some random starving Egyptian guy laying out in the middle of the field. No, this turned out to be an Egyptian who was actually a servant of an Amalekite leader. And according to his own testimony, after they had gone into Ziklag and burned it down with fire, on their way out, he had become ill, and that's when his Amalekite master decided to leave him behind to die. Clearly, there's no benevolence in the heart of that Amalekite leader. He's like, "Oh, you're sick? You're slowing us down? We don't have time for this. Good luck. Sorry. Can't help you." There's no benevolence in the heart of this Amalekite leader, and yet here's David. You know, this Egyptian just helped burn down this guy's house. This Egyptian had just helped these Amalekites capture David's wife and kids, and yet here's David nursing him back to health, showing true benevolence. Well, then after receiving the benevolent help of David and his men, this Egyptian servant, he was willing and able to help And he was willing and able to lead David and his men to the camp of his former master. And upon their arrival, David and his men, they attacked the Amalekites, and they did this over the course of 24 hours. We actually learned in our text that the attack happened from twilight until the evening of the next day, and so that's about 24 hours. Well, thanks to the help of this starving servant, David was able to recover everything that the Amalekites had taken from them, including their wives, including all of their sons and all of their daughters. From this, we see then how a beautiful act of benevolence, it provided David and his men with the intel that they needed to overtake the enemy and rescue their family from the wicked intentions of the Amalekites. And while it's true that those who choose to help the helpless will oftentimes benefit from their own acts of benevolence, I want to point out that true benevolence isn't focused on what we might receive in return. You see, I don't think that David stopped to help this Egyptian who was starving there in the field, you know, with the idea that, well, maybe I can get something out of him. I don't think that he was helping this Egyptian and feeding this Egyptian man because he was hoping to be able to get something back. I believe that it was just an act of benevolence because it was the right thing to do to help this helpless man. But as a result, well, he received intelligence that he needed to capture these Amalekites. But we have to understand that true benevolence isn't based on what I'm going to get out of this, but what I give to this situation. True benevolence is simply based on a desire to help the helpless. And in order to further explain my point, if you would, hold your place here at 1 Samuel and turn with me to Luke chapter 10. As you turn to Luke 10, we should take a moment to consider some of the various drivers for benevolent giving. For some people, the benevolence of a charitable gift, it's fueled by the desire to receive tax breaks. Rather than helping the helpless because it's just the right thing to do, these people actually help the helpless because it's a good way to receive tax deductions at the end of the year. And so, sure, they give, you know, a lot of money, or they give, you know, oftentimes to charitable causes, but in the back of their mind, they're only doing it because it's going to give them better tax breaks at the end of the year. Other people, they're interested in appearances as they give charitably. In other words, these people are more concerned about how they're viewed in the eyes of their community, and so they help the helpless, but only because they want to be seen as wonderful philanthropists who are giving to the less than fortunate. Now, maybe you've never struggled with this, but maybe you have. For example, have you ever been in line at a grocery store and someone says, would you like to give a dollar to diabetes? Would you like to give $5 to breast cancer research? And you're thinking, well, if I say no, then the person next to me is going to think that I'm a real jerk, and so I'm going to go ahead and give that money. If you've ever done that, then it's not real benevolence. You did it because you didn't want to look bad in front of this person sitting next to you, or you didn't want the cashier to think that you're some sort of animal who doesn't care about people with diabetes or breast cancer. That's not real charitable, benevolent giving. No, you're giving because it's all about you. It's all about your appearance. Then there are those who engage in acts of benevolence because they're hoping for some good karma at the end of the day. They think, well, if I do something good for someone, then someone else is going to do something good for me. And they think that it'll all come around and bless me in the end. And so that's why we give. In other words, their desire to help the helpless has less to do with helping the helpless, and it has more to do with their own desire to be helped by others on the day when they find themselves in a helpless situation. And wouldn't you know, when that day comes and they're helpless and no one's helping them, they're all mad because they have helped so many people and no one's helping them. Well, yeah, you did it for the wrong reason. Now, as we consider all these reasons for engaging in acts of benevolence, we must understand that each of these drivers, they all fall short of true Christian benevolence. Because listen, true Christian benevolence, it leads us to help the helpless simply because the love of Christ compels us to help them. It's the charity of Christ that leads us to help those who need our help. And with this in mind, we should consider the story of the Good Samaritan that's actually found here in Luke chapter 10. And so if you would look with me, I want to begin reading at verse 30, because there Jesus told the story about a certain man who went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a certain priest came down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked, and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out two denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, "Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you." So which of these three do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? And he said, "He who showed mercy on him." Then Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." Here in these verses, Jesus tells us that classic story about a good Samaritan man. This Samaritan who came across this other man who had been badly beaten, stripped of his clothes, robbed of all of his money. This guy had nothing to offer the world at this point in time. But rather than passing him by saying, "Well, this guy can't do anything for me," no, he stopped and helped. And unlike the priest, unlike the Levite, the Samaritan stopped and helped the helpless man, not for what he could get out of the helpless man, but simply because it was the right thing to do. Well, Jesus was presenting us with a contrast between the Samaritan and these religious men who refused to help. And oftentimes when we read this story, that's the comparison we make, the Samaritan and the two other religious men. But there's also another contrast that can be easily missed here, and it's the contrast between the Samaritan and the innkeeper. You see, the innkeeper also helped this helpless man. The innkeeper put him up until he was well. The innkeeper spent his own money to help this person back to his own health. And yet, Jesus doesn't commend the innkeeper. And why is that? Well, because the innkeeper was doing it for payment. The man said, when I come back, I will pay you back. I will reimburse you. I will bless you for blessing this man. So the innkeeper helped, but he helped under the condition that he would receive what he gave, but not the Samaritan. The Samaritan simply gave. He gave without expecting anything in return. He helped this helpless man because it was the right thing to do. And that's why Jesus commends the Samaritan. And listen, he says, "Now you go and do likewise." We should go and do likewise. That when we see the person, the helpless person who desperately needs some help, that we stop and we help that helpless person, because that's what the Lord would have us to do. From the example that's presented in this parable, we should become believers who are able to reveal the beauty of benevolence because we're helping those who are unable to help themselves. Well, it's true that the beauty of benevolence can be clearly seen whenever we help the helpless, but I'd also like to point out that the beauty of benevolence can also be seen when we provide for the powerless. And with this in mind, let's turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 30, because there we find David providing for the powerless. If you would look with me beginning at verse 20. There we learn that David took all the flocks and herds that they had driven before those other livestock, and said, "This is David's spoil." Now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they also had made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart." But David said, "My brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike." So it was from that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. Now, here in these verses, we find David. He's not only recovering what was taken from their homes there in Ziklag, but he also claimed possession of all the spoil that the Amalekites left behind. Remember, they had invaded all sorts of different areas, including the southern parts of Judah. And so David's saying, hey, all of this is mine. He claimed all of this spoil. And it'll help us to understand that the spoil, that word spoil, it comes from a Hebrew word which refers to the possessions that a soldier acquires after defeating their enemy in battle. And so after David and his men defeated the Amalekites, the Hebrew victors claimed the possessions of the Amalekites as their own, or they took what they had robbed and claimed it for themselves. While there was no question that the spoil of the Amalekites now belonged to the Hebrew victors, the victorious Israelites, they didn't want to share this spoil with those men who had stayed behind at the brook Besor. Now, with this in mind, notice again there in verse 22, because there we learn that all those wicked and worthless men, and that's what David calls those men who went with him. He calls them wicked and worthless men. And he says that these wicked and worthless men said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Now, here in this verse, we find the 400 men who were able to fight against the Amalekites. They're making their case against the 200 men who were too weak to move beyond the brook Besor. And according to these men, the 200 men who had no power to move forward, the 200 men who had no power to fight against the Amalekites, they should not only be excluded from receiving a portion of the spoil, but they ought to take their wives and their children and leave Ziklag altogether. They just wanted them to go away. So they're saying, you're not going to get any of the spoil, and we want you gone. We want you out of here. Well, thankfully for those men, David wasn't of the same mindset. David was actually a benevolent leader who understood the value of providing for the powerless. And here in our text, he demonstrates the beauty of benevolence by providing for these powerless people. And with this in mind, if you would look with me there at verse 23, because there David says, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. Now, as we consider the beginning of David's argument here, we must understand that, according to David, it was the Lord who had given them the power to defeat the Amalekites. He's not thinking for one second that, yeah, we, in and of ourselves, in and of our power, went and found these Amalekites and defeated them, and so we did all the work, and so the spoil is ours. That's not what David is saying. David is saying, look, God is the one who delivered this troop into our hands. God is the one who helped us to come across this Egyptian man. God is the one who gave us a heart of benevolence to help him out. God is the one who used him to direct us to where the Amalekites were. And God is the one who gave us the power to actually defeat this army as soon as we found them. And so the spoil that they had acquired, it was actually a benevolent gift from God. God gave them that spoil. God gave them those benevolent gifts. And David's saying, look, if God has given us these benevolent gifts, then should we not share with those who stayed by the supplies? Should we not be benevolent, having become the recipients of God's benevolence? Well, after reminding these men that they, in fact, were the recipients of God's benevolence, David went on to remind them that the 200 men who were unable to fight, they still served their purpose. And with this in mind, if you would look with me there at verse 24, there David asked, for who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. Now here in the second part of David's argument, David was reminding the 400 that the 200 men who had no power to fight, the 200 men who had no power to move forward, they were the same men who actually stayed behind to protect the gear of those who moved forward and fought. You see, if all of the men had been forced to carry all of their own gear all the way to the Amalekite camp, then the chances are they would have all been too exhausted to fight when they got there. And so part of God's plan was for these 200 men to stay behind so that the 400 could shed their heavy equipment and just take what they needed so that they would have the energy to fight as soon as they got to the Amalekite camp. And so the 200 men who stayed behind, they served their purpose. They served their purpose by protecting the equipment, which empowered the rest of the men to move forward without the burden of all their heavy equipment. And so from David's point of view, God's people should reveal the beauty of benevolence by providing for those who are powerless. According to God's plan here, God empowers some of us to do more. He doesn't empower some of us, and they end up doing less. But according to God, we should all share alike in what he's provided. I should point out that David felt so strongly about this that he ended up passing laws in Israel so that the powerless would be provided for according to the benevolent plan of God. With this in mind, notice again there, verse 25. There we learn that from that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. Or in other words, David passed laws which would ensure that those who were powerless would still be provided for. And from this example, I believe that we should take a moment to consider how the beauty of benevolence is revealed when the people of God go out of their way to provide for those who don't have the power to provide for themselves. Now, this is our focus. If you would hold your place there in the book of 1 Samuel, but turn with me to 1 John chapter 3. As you turn to 1 John chapter 3, I want to take a moment to define what I mean when I say powerless. You see, because there are those who ask for our benevolence by claiming to be powerless, and yet all they're really doing is looking for a free ride so that they can avoid the responsibility of working. They just want the free ride. They want the free check. For example, there are those who, they'll show up to this church on a Sunday, typically right after service. And they'll start sharing their sad story with anyone who will listen to them. They'll stand outside or they'll walk down the hallway and they'll share their sad story about how they're out of gas or how they have no food or whatever the sad story is. And all the while, all they're hoping for is someone to dig into their wallet or dig into their purse and pull out some cash and give it to them because we have this heart that bleeds for them and we have this desire to show the beauty of benevolence. This reminds me of a man who stopped by the church just a few weeks ago. It was right after first service. And he came in, he was talking to people about money and his need for money, and his truck had run out of gas, and he was worried that it was going to get towed, and you know, he needed to put some gas in the tank so that he could get out of there. And so I asked him where his truck was, and he told me where it was. I said, well, it's not going to get towed there, don't worry. I said, hang out during second service, enjoy the Bible study, it's going to be a great one. And then afterwards, we'll talk about where your truck is and how we can get some gas in your truck. I told him, I said, I'm not going to give you any cash, but what I will do is I will get some gas in your truck so that you can get on your way, and we'll make sure that you're able to get on your way. So just hang out, enjoy the Bible study. We'll talk after second service. Well, as soon as I told him this, you know what he did? He turned around and he left the church. He walked straight out of the church and went on his merry way, and the reason why is because he wanted cash. He wanted me to hand him some money so that he could actually go do with it what he wanted. There was no truck broken down anywhere. There was no truck out of gas. He just wanted some cash. Well, he probably thought that that would be the last time he'd ever see me again. But it was the next day. I was having breakfast at Central Market, and this same guy walks into Central Market. And he walks over to an elderly lady sitting at a table next to me and begins to tell her the same sad story. He's scamming this elderly lady now, and she's buying it. And I'm just looking straight at him, hoping to make some eye contact, and finally he looks at me and recognizes me, and his eyes get real big, but he keeps running his scam. And this lady gives him some money, and I told her, I said, sorry to tell you that you just got scammed by a scammer. And sure enough, I see the guy exiting Central Market, going to the next door down and coming back into the grocery store, heading back to the liquor aisle because he's going to take that money and go buy himself some booze. That's what he's going to do with that money. So we have to be careful because there are scammers out there, scammers who are going to want to come into the church and tell us their sad story so that we pull out our cash and give it to them, and they're going to go use it for all the wrong reasons. So if anybody comes up to you here at our church and asks you for money, just send them straight to me. Seriously, just say, hey, talk to my pastor over here. He'd love to meet with you. You see, I'm interested in providing benevolence to people, but only after they get a little counseling as well. I want to find out what is their problem. I want to find out how do we solve that problem. And then if there's a true need for benevolent money or food or what have you, then we can meet that need along the way. But it's also going to weed out the scammers. It's going to weed out those who don't want to work and they just want a free ride. We haven't been called to provide for those who refuse to work. We must remember the Lord has not called us to pave the way for those who have the power to work but choose not to. No, instead, our benevolence should be directed to those who cannot provide for themselves. If you're wondering where I get this from, Paul told the Christians in Thessalonica that if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. In other words, if you have the ability to work and you choose not to, don't expect to eat. And so it's not our job to provide for those who simply refuse to work. Now, it's true that there are scammers out there who are attempting to abuse our call to become benevolent believers. And yet at the same time, there are those who truly are powerless to provide for themselves. I can think of a few groups like orphans. Orphans who have no parents to provide for them. They need help. They're powerless to provide for themselves. There are elderly widows out there who are barely scraping by on Social Security, and they don't have any family to support them. Those are people who desperately need help because they're powerless to provide for themselves. There's all sorts of people out there who truly are powerless to provide for themselves, and those are the people that we want to focus on. With these powerless people in mind, let's consider what John wrote here in his first epistle. If you would look with me there at chapter 3, verse 16. There John writes, "By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth." Now, here in these verses, the Apostle John helps us to see that the Christian can talk about Christian love all day long. You can, talk all about the love of God all day long. But the true Christian love, the true love of Christ that should fill our hearts, it ought to be a love that leads us to engage in the sort of good works which would cause us to take the goods that God has given us and share it with those who cannot provide for themselves. You see, God has given most of us the power to work. God has given most of us the ability to go and get a job and bring in a paycheck and use that money for all sorts of things. But it's sad to say that too many Christians take that whole paycheck and they say, well, all of this belongs to me, so I'm going to use it in the way that I see fit. Well, wait a minute. Isn't your ability that you're using to work a benevolent gift from God? Isn't your job, the very fact that you have a job and can bring in a paycheck, isn't that a benevolent gift from God? I would say yes. And if your abilities and your employment and your paycheck, if all of that is a benevolent gift from God, then can you truly say that all of it belongs to you? I would say not. And according to David, we ought to take the benevolence that God has given to us and dedicate some of it to others. That's why it's important to take the money that God has given to us and to say, okay, I'm going to take a portion of this. I'm going to support my church and the benevolence that's going on at this church. I'm going to support what God is doing in my community. I'm going to provide for those who cannot provide for themselves. You see, Paul encouraged the Hebrew believers in the first century. He told them that they should not forget to do good and to share. Now, as parents, I'm sure many of you are teaching your kids right now how to share, but have we forgotten? Do we actually practice what we preach? Do we take what God has given us and share it? Or do we just hold on to it and it's just for me and my family? We must understand that God is calling us to share. He's calling us to demonstrate His love by taking the benevolent provisions that He's given us and share it with those who cannot provide for themselves. And while it's true that God could just supernaturally provide for those people, I mean, He could take a person who's powerless to provide for themselves and He could just make $1 million appear in their bank account. He could do that. But you see, that's just a win. And I believe that God is going for a win-win. I believe that God wants to use believers and help them to understand the importance of benevolence so that as we take a portion of what God has given to us and give it to someone who can't provide for themselves, it's a win-win. Because the believer who shares is a growing Christian. And then not only that, but the one who can't provide for themselves is provided for. And so God is calling us to reflect and demonstrate the beauty of his own benevolent nature by taking what he's given to us and sharing it with those who are powerless to provide for themselves. And so we see here then that we reveal the beauty of benevolence whenever we help the helpless, and we reveal the beauty of benevolence whenever we provide for the powerless. But finally, I want to talk about how we reveal the beauty of benevolence when we bring hope to the hopeless. With this in mind, let's turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 30, because there we find David bringing hope to the hopeless. If you would look with me there at verse 26, there we learn that when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, "Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, to those who were in Bethel, those who were in Ramoth of the south, those who were in Jatir, those who were in Aror, those who were in Siphmoth, those who were in Eshtemoah, those who were in Rachel, those who were in the cities of the Jeremelites, those who were in the cities of the Kenites, those who were in Hormah, those who were in Korishan, those who were in Athak, those who were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove." Now here in these verses we find David taking a portion of the spoil and he's dividing it amongst the elders of Judah. And we see that this benevolent gift from David was sent out to these various cities all throughout the southern end of Judah. And it's almost like David's paying it back because these were the places that he was hiding out when he was running from King Saul. But not only was he paying it back, but I believe that he was bringing hope to the hopeless. And I'm going to guess that the Israelites all throughout this region were very hopeless. I should first point out that the Israelites in these cities of Judah, they were constantly being raided by the enemies of Israel. As a matter of fact, if you would look back at verse 14, there we learn that the Egyptian servant told David, "We made an invasion of the southern area of the Cherethites in the territory which belongs to Judah and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." Here we see that the Amalekites had not only invaded the land of the Philistines, but they had also invaded the southern area of Judah. And I would imagine that this was an ongoing situation. I'm guessing that these Israelites were constantly being robbed by the enemies of Israel. I should remind you that the Lord had commanded Saul to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Unfortunately, Saul had failed to accomplish this mission. You see, God knew that the Amalekites would continue to rob and kill the Israelites. And so he told Saul, "Get rid of them. Destroy them." But Saul failed to do it. And as a result, the Israelites in the southern area of Judah, they were constantly being attacked, invaded, and robbed. Now imagine the feeling of hopelessness that you would experience. I'm guessing that some of us maybe have come home to a house that had been robbed. Remember that feeling of hopelessness as you realized someone has been in your house. Someone has taken what you worked hard for. Imagine the sense of hopelessness as you realize the cops are never going to find my stuff. The cops are never going to be able to locate that television or that stereo or that whatever. Just hopeless. And then the fear of, well, if it can happen once, it can happen again. So I can go back and buy all this stuff again, but what's going to stop someone else from coming in? There's just hopelessness there. And if you've lived in an area where thieves could break in and take everything from you, I mean, you would start thinking about moving probably. But now imagine living in an area where these robbers could just come in and take whatever they wanted, all the while knowing that your king is too busy to enforce the justice that brings restoration and retribution. You know that there's not going to be any cops out there looking for your stuff. And you know that there's no one protecting your border from these people coming back and doing it again. And so there would just be like this sense of hopelessness in the hearts of these Israelites. And this is exactly what these Israelites found themselves in the middle of. Now, with that being the case, it's probably safe to assume that these families in Judah, they were broke because they were constantly being robbed. They were living without hope, knowing that their kids could be captured and kidnapped, their livestock, whatever. And while Saul didn't seem to be interested in helping these Israelites with any sort of benevolent assistance, David was clearly a man who understood the beauty of benevolence. It was with a desire to bring hope to the hopeless that I believe David sent these benevolent gifts to the cities of Judah. I believe that he tried to restore what was rightfully theirs into their hands, and in so doing, restore hope into their hearts. Now, with this example in mind, we should consider the importance of using benevolence to bring hope to the hopeless. And if you would, then turn with me to James chapter 2. And as you turn to James 2, I should point out that the world is filled with people who have no hope. The world is filled with people who started out with a heart filled with hope, but now they've been crushed. You see, the world system in which we live has convinced us that the pursuit of wealth is the path of true happiness, and so we're all running after making the big bucks. And as a result, there are a lot of people who are falling for all sorts of get-rich-quick scams. They think that, well, if they just invest in this little money-making venture, that it'll have great payoff, and I'll be rich in the end. And so they invest in this pyramid scheme, and they invest in all this product, hoping that they can sell it to their friends, and they have all these little parties, and they try to move this product, and in the end, all they end up with is a bunch of product that they can't move and no money. I watched it happen to my stepmother. When I was a kid, she bought all kinds of Mary Kay products, thinking that she was going to get rich on this stuff, and in the end, all she ended up with was a garage full of makeup and no money. It broke her. But they tell you, oh, you can make all kinds of money. Yeah, all you got to do is just convince everybody else to sell your stuff for you. And it's just a pyramid scheme. And yeah, some people end up with the pink Cadillac. But most of you end up with just a bunch of Mary Kay or whatever the product is, whatever it is that you fell into. Be careful. Because while you might have great hope in selling this product, most people are left hopeless because they end up broke with just a bunch of product. Then there are those who were promised a pot of gold by traveling on the rainbow road of higher learning. These people take out thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in student loans, and they go off to college, and as soon as they graduate, they think, okay, here comes the big job. And then they graduate and find out, there is no job waiting for me. There's so much unemployment in America right now that there's many people who are graduating from colleges with no hope because there's no work. I can't even tell you how many waitresses and waiters I've met who are college graduates attempting to pay off student loans on the money that a waiter or a waitress makes. They're crushed. They're hopeless because they're broke and they can't get into the workforce that they went to school for. Without a doubt, there are many troubling stories. I could just go on and on with all sorts of troubling stories of people who set out with all the hope in the world to get all the money that they needed, only to end up broke. And listen, I believe that God brings these people across our path all the time. Chances are you know people at work who are hopelessly broke. Chances are you know people that you interact with, you know, whether it's at the grocery store or at the park or even here at church, people who find themselves so hopelessly broke that they have no hope. As we consider these people who have found themselves just at this point of hopelessness, consider what James says here in James chapter 2, beginning at verse 14. There James asks, "What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked or destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Depart in peace, be warmed and filled,' but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also, by faith itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, 'You have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works.' You believe that there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. But do you want to know, foolish man, that faith without works is dead?" Now, here in these verses, James presents us with a tough question concerning the evidence of our faith. Without a doubt, this text is highly controversial, and most of the cults in the world will point to these verses and say, "See, according to James, you have to have faith plus works if you want to be saved." But that's not what James is saying here. We have to remember that the context of the book of James is what our faith looks like in the eyes of the world around us. Or in other words, what justifies our claim to be Christian in the eyes of the people around us? Here in this text, James was asking us about the kind of faith that fails to lead us into a life of good works. What kind of faith is that? What kind of faith would lead us into a life that is just like the life we lived before we trusted in Jesus Christ? And if someone comes along and says, "I have faith in God," but doesn't live like they have faith in God, can that faith save them? Absolutely not, because it's not true faith. You see, anyone can say that they have faith. Anybody can say anything they want. I can tell you that I play for the NBA, that I can jam a ball with one jump, no problem. Do you believe me? I wouldn't. It's just a claim. It doesn't mean anything. It's easily rejected when you look at the evidence. And the person who says, I have faith in God, but doesn't live like they have faith in God, where's the evidence of their faith? The person who has true saving faith in Jesus Christ isn't working for salvation. They're working because of their salvation. And the person who has true saving faith in Jesus Christ will be moved by the love of the Lord to demonstrate a faith through their good works. And listen, one of the best ways to demonstrate our faith in Jesus is by revealing the beauty of our Savior's benevolence. And what this means is this: the true Christian who has true faith in God will begin to care less about how much we can acquire for ourselves, and we'll begin to care more about how we can help meet the needs of those around us who are hopeless and hopelessly broke. Now, as we consider the beauty of benevolence here, I should remind you that Jesus is the perfect picture of God's omnibenevolent nature. Jesus is our model. If you want to know what it means to be a benevolent being, look at Jesus Christ. Study his life and see how he cared for the people around him. But we have to understand that a benevolence without evangelism is nothing more than Christless social helps. I say this because there are people and churches in the world today who are stressing social helps. They want to go and provide water for those who have no water, and that's a good thing. They want to put clothes on the backs of those who have no clothes, and that's good. They want to provide food and shelter for those who have no food and shelter. And again, great works. Very benevolent works. But it's sad to say that there are many organizations and even churches now who are doing all of these social helps without preaching the gospel to those that they're helping. Now I ask you, what will it matter on the day of judgment if we made sure that everyone was fat, warm, and happy, but not saved? We kept them fat, warm, and happy until the day they went to hell. What did we do? Absolutely nothing. What did we accomplish? Absolutely nothing. And so we must be careful that our benevolence is mixed with evangelism, because that is the model that Jesus Christ presents us with. It's a benevolent love that points to the greatest amount of love, which is found at the cross of Christ. So we can go on our medical mission trips, and we can work in soup kitchens, and we can go feed the naked and all this sort of stuff. But it has to come with the message of Jesus Christ and him crucified for sins. Otherwise, it's not true benevolence. Benevolence without evangelism is nothing more than a powerless social gospel. Listen, I believe that the Lord is calling us to reflect his benevolent nature. I believe that the Lord is calling us to help the helpless. He's calling us to provide for the powerless. He's calling us to bring hope to the hopeless. But we must understand that the way that we accomplish these things is by sharing what God has given us and then sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. That way we can lead people to the true benevolence, which is the forgiveness of sins. It's a forgiveness that results in a benevolent love that we'll receive for the rest of eternity. And so I would encourage you, in the name of Jesus Christ, help the helpless, provide for the powerless, bring hope to the hopeless, and as we do, we'll become believers who are demonstrating the beauty of benevolence. Let's pray.